Welcome to Tonic Boom, a specialist capital markets podcast series brought to you by Tonic, the expertise-led consultancy dedicated to giving firms more. Join our host, our resident Tonic ninjas, and industry experts as we drop the mic on the hot market topics across high-profile domains such as margin, post-trade, treasury, risk, digital, legal, sustainability, and more. More expertise, more trust, more achieved. Ready for your dose of Tonic?
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and a very warm welcome to Tonic Boom. For those tuning in for the first time, Boom is Tonic's expertise-led podcast series covering the hottest topics across capital markets and beyond. I'm Philip Forgan, Tonic's head of collateral, and today I'm taking over the reins from Chris Watts and hosting what I expect to be an exciting and lively discussion. Today's Boom is entitled Next Steps in US Treasury Clearing Documentation and is the next instalment in Tonic's podcast series dedicated to US Treasury clearing. The goal today is to chat through, in practical terms, how the industry is looking to address documentation challenges in preparation for the US Treasury clearing mandates. And to help us out today, we are privileged to have the good folk from D2 Legal Technology with us. For those who don't know, D2 Legal Technology, or D2LT, is an award-winning legal data consulting firm that acts as a trusted advisor to institutions on process, data, and the use of technology to unlock business value through legal change. As usual, we have a splendid group of specialists here today, both from D2LT and Tonic, all of whom have deep hands-on experience to talk about documentation challenges associated with the US Treasury clearing mandates. Firstly, we have Emma Woolridge and Sydney Hassel. Guys, do you mind introducing yourselves?
Hi, yeah, thank you for the intro. I'm Emma Woolridge. I'm a lawyer and consultant at D2LT, and I've been working closely with Sydney on our service offering around US Treasury clearing, and I'm really excited to be here today.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sydney Hassel. I'm the managing consultant for Canada for D2LT. And as Emma mentioned, we've been working together on this for quite a while to be able to track the background issues and put some ideas together, which we're really anxious to share with you today.
Thank you, Sydney. Thank you, Emma. Great to have you on board. And Mr. Cook, do you mind introducing yourself, please?
Yes, thanks, Phil. My name is Phil Cook. I'm the head of post-trade for Tonic and working very closely with Phil Forkin on the US Treasury clearing initiatives.
Thank you, Phil. So, as many of you who listen to Tonic podcasts may know, we have the Two Truths and One Lie Challenge, which is a fan favorite. And actually, this gives a bit more insight into our guests. So, Sydney, I understand that you're stepping up for this one today.
I am, although I don't think I'm the victim here. I think it's Emma that has to guess, and she's the victim here. So, here we go. Two truths and a lie. First one, I speak French. The second one, I was president of a symphony orchestra. And the third one, I can ride a horse, milk a cow, and drive a tractor.
All right. I'm going to take first guess. I think the lie is that you speak French because you're supposed to because you're in Canada, but maybe you don't.
Okay, Emma, what's your guess?
Oh, I was going to go with speaking French as well, because you live in Canada, so I also had the same reasoning there. But the third one is fantastic, and I hope it's true.
Anybody else, Phil?
I need to remain impartial. I'm the judge and the jury. I'll let the good Mr. Cook bat this one for Tonic.
Really, I didn't make that difficult enough, because it is indeed that I do not speak French. I'm still at the stage where I have to translate my English thoughts into French, which takes me a lot of time, so I would not call myself a French speaker at all.
Excellent.
I'm so glad the third one's true.
Great work. Right. Okay, without further ado, let's now focus on the objective of today, which is to look at the documentation challenges associated with US Treasury clearing. But before we start, it'd be remiss not just to give everyone an update on the implementation deadlines. As you probably all know, SEC announced an extension to the compliance dates, basically extending the dates by 1 year. So if the requirement to clear eligible cash transactions has been extended from December 31, 2025 out to December 31, 2026. And the secondary requirement to clear US Treasury repo transactions has been extended from 31st of June 26 out to the 31st of June 2027. So whilst the industry breathes a collective sigh of relief and the extension is very welcome, it doesn't mean that folks can down tools. So Phil, what does this really sort of mean for the industry at the moment?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that we'll see. You know, ever since the announcement, there's been a pretty strong uptick in sponsored services and folks signing up and even, you know, volumes of sponsored repo. I think we'll see that temper a bit now that we have these extensions. I think a big part of the reason for the extension, CME and, you know, ICE put their name in the hat to become CCP. CME is officially registered. So I think this gives them enough time to get set up and have an offering for the market. Also, the agent clearing model with FICC GSD has not been, you know, well established. It's not a robust offering across the market quite yet. And there are a lot of folks interested in that access model. So I think allowing those agent clearing members to get set up and also the additional CCPs, I think that's why we have this extension and we'll use the time wisely.
So it seems like a lot to be done, a lot to consider in that time.
I was just going to say off the back of one of the points that Phil raised, the slow in the sponsored service sign up that we might see as a result of this delay. And while I do agree, I also think we will see this remain as a super important service offering and we will still see institutions signing up to this because it's been around in the market for a while. People are more comfortable with it and there's sort of more defined operating model around that. So I think we will continue to see firms pushing forward in that area as we move through the new timelines.
Okay, so that's a really nice segue into what are the sort of the access models that firms need to consider? I think there's broadly three, and we'll get Phil Cook just to sort of elaborate. Direct netting, sponsored clearing services, and agent clearing services. Phil, do you just want to give a bit more color on where the focus is on those key access models?
Yeah, sure, thanks. We've covered this in some other podcasts, but just to level set for the listeners on this one, so there's a direct access or netting member, or in CME terms, it would be an independent user. These are firms that go direct to the CCP, so they will, you know, net their settlements, deliver collateral directly. They are responsible for essentially their book and everything that they do. That's not really going to be a focus for our discussion today because that documentation, well, one is just not going to be as prevalent. We do expect a lot of the buy side firms and folks who are not clearing today to use other firms and service providers to get access. So we're just not going to focus on that from a documentation perspective today. The other two models that we will discuss in FICC GSD terms, there's the sponsored services. So this service focuses on done with trading. We won't really talk about that too much more. We'll just refer to these as sponsored and agent clearing going forward. But done with services, the end client does the trade directly with the firm that's going to submit their trade for clearing. So the sponsoring members submits both their side of the trade and the client side of the trade. It's just a one-to-one relationship and not too complex and confusing as Emma was referring to. Then there's the agent clearing model, which has spun out of the prime and correspondent models at FICC GSD. This model was introduced to support done-away trading. So this is where a firm who needs access to clearing can trade with multiple parties in the market and then give up their trade to one or more agent clearing members to get access.
Thank you, Phil. That's a really sort of comprehensive overview of the different access models that firms will need to consider when they start to navigate the Treasury clearing mandate. So if we use that as a pivot towards the documentation requirements around the different types of clearing models, Sydney, can you give us some views on what's on the mind of industry participants at the moment from a documentation perspective?
Right, thanks. I think one of the things that's interesting is, and I'm just going to piggyback on what Emma had said earlier about the activity in the sponsored segment. Not that that's the focus of our discussion today, but anecdotally, it takes almost 9 months to get a sponsored setup done. And one of the observations regarding that documentation is the variety of choices that have been made available in it. It's designed to be a one-size-fits-all document. And the consequence of that is that it does cover a lot of options and in turn generates a lot of complexity. So one of the interesting things has been that we have seen industry participants, large dealers, actually modify that document, produce some kind of a chopped down or bespoke form of that document to address their different client groups in order to make it a little bit easier and make it a little bit more straightforward. Again, because you have a spectrum of clients, you're also perhaps going to need a spectrum of documentation to address that issue.
Yeah, Sydney, you mentioned some folks that may be less used to this stuff. I was just thinking there very well could be, you know, folks that they really don't use derivatives today. So I do liken this, you know, agent clearing model to a lot of the derivatives clearing setups that we have today. But if you introduce, you know, the cleared U.S. Treasury repo for repo users today who are not trading derivatives, this would be net new for them, right? And would create some potentially significant change at their firms.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that there has been a lot of growth in, I guess, what you would call the small client repo market, meaning a lot of smaller corporate treasuries have become interested in using repos in order to manage their cash balances because it's more efficient than standard deposit accounts. So I think that over the last maybe 5 years, there have been a lot of smaller corporate treasuries that have come into the fold. And those are clients that probably don't have the sophistication that you were talking about or the experience with the OTC derivatives that you were talking about. So this is definitely going to be something that is new to them, and the complexities of it may seem quite overwhelming for them.
Okay, that's really interesting. That's great insight into the sort of the challenges that people will face. So in terms of the documentation, can you give us a bit of an overview around the pros and cons of customized documentation versus the industry standards? It seems like it will be appropriate for certain clients to use customized documentation, whereas others will feel more comfortable with an industry standard documentation. Can you give us a bit of an overview of what those pros and cons are?
Sure, I'll start that and I'll leave a little bit for Emma here. So I think that, you know, the pros are that you do have standardization and that then across the industry, you're looking at consistency. It will improve, I think, the consistency of data reporting and it will improve the expectations of market participants as time goes on. You know, standardized documentation is much easier to deal with because everybody kind of knows where they are with it. So it forms a really sound and secure basis for the process. The challenge with this would be that the documentation that is available, as I mentioned, is fairly complex. And that's because it's designed to encompass many different forms of trade. It's designed to cover both the cash and the term repos or the other repos that use U.S. Treasuries as collateral. It's something that maybe for, as we mentioned, for unsophisticated players is a little overwhelming. Emma, did you want to jump in here?
Sure. Thanks, Sydney. I think that on top of all of those items, I think the CIFMA documentation, of course, comes with the confidence and stamp of approval of a trading association, which some of these clients who aren't so familiar with the access models and the world of clearing and are having to come to paper these relationships that they may not have had to in the past, especially in the cash space, I think they can come more comfortably to the table when there is something like that stamp of approval there. But of course, with the complications that come with that standalone document, it also can be more helpful to these clients to have a limited document that a institution has developed over time and is comfortable kind of negotiating and is familiar with, because then the client has this maybe more narrow list of terms and provisions that they need to look at rather than these tick boxes of kind of elements that aren't really relevant for that given relationship. So I think both come with their pros and cons. Of course, with the sponsored space where it has developed previously, not just as a result of this new regulation, institutions do already have their docs that they've developed, their template annexes to MRAs and GMRAs. So that's another reason institutions may prefer the customized documentation, because that's what they have been working with and have developed internally already. So pros and cons to both, as with everything, really.
Yeah. And as we see this agent model develop, and, you know, for CME terms, it's the supported user model. If you, again, likening to the derivatives market with FCM agreements or cleared OTC agreements, these firms will potentially have different offerings, different economic structures, different liability limitations, different things that they'll want to put into their documentation, right?
And that's a great point, Phil, because obviously at the moment, there's the opportunity for other CCPs to be involved in this clearing mandate. So at the moment, FIC is the only SEC registered clearinghouse, but we anticipate CME, ICE, and maybe others over time to offer services in this space. So Emma and Sydney, with that in mind, with new CCPs offering services, how does that change the documentation sort of discussion and considerations?
Well, I think there has to be a commonality across all clearing providers that would be in line with the documentation itself. So very much once you start involving a clearinghouse or a CCA, what you have is you have their rule book that becomes sort of a basis for how the business will proceed or how trading will actually proceed. And I think the other thing that's interesting out of this will be what market participants will do in terms of what their service offerings are for clients, where you have a cross-section of service providers available. Clearing service providers available, will market participants offer clients a choice? Or will they say, no, we only, you know, offer clearing services from ABC or whatever the firm happens to be? And then on the back of that, will they also be offering client substitute products? I think that's going to be interesting. And I think that that may be dependent to a certain extent on what happens with respect to the development of cross-product netting rules and whether or not dealers actually offer different clients different service offerings.
Okay, so it seems, Sydney, that there are more questions than answers at this moment in time, and that the extensions are really well warranted because there's lots of questions that the industry needs to coalesce around to make sure they come to an agreement in terms of what these standards should be and how they get reflected in the documentation. So that's a really useful bit of insight, and I think our listeners will be glad to hear that. So just switching gears, so what should our clients be doing today? So looking at it from timing and best practice, what do you think firms should be doing today? And what have you been hearing from the industry forums? It'll be great to get some insights into that. Emma, is that one for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I can lead off on that and Sydney can add anything afterwards. So, well, we think what really is important right now is not laying down the pens just because there's been a delay. I think there was this push to get the delay, and it is, as you just said, really well received and welcome within the industry because there's still lots to do. But as a result of that, I think the delay puts firms in a really strong position to have a project team build this the right way, continue discussions about the right operating models for them internally and for their clients. I think what you can always be doing at the beginning of these things that is super important to the stakeholders within the project is scoping and prioritizing your client list. So look at the counterparties and clients that you're trading repo and cash US Treasuries with, and turn that into a list that you can prioritize within the stakeholding teams. And that can really be, and that sort of planning and project approach can really help teams like negotiation teams, documentation teams, when the access models and templates and guidebooks, playbooks are ready to push this forward.
Yeah, our motto has always been start early and maintain momentum. And that's a key takeaway that we have from all of our compliance-based support work that D2LT has done. This is something that we see repeated over and over again with every project, not just the U.S. Treasury repo. It's just something that we recommend for everybody. And it's really easy once you get a delay or once you get an extension for a compliance deadline to say, oh, thank goodness, we have another year. We have time. Now we can breathe out. Now we don't have quite so much to do. And the problem with that is that you lose momentum. And once you lose momentum, it's very difficult sometimes to get started again. Because usually what happens within the space of the delay or within the extension for compliance is that complexities arise. So if you don't stay on top of it, you soon find that you're confronting not only a bit of a backlog, but then additional complexities that maybe you hadn't thought of when the original extension was proposed. So that kind of our recommendation. There are two things that we've kind of observed that we think need to be considered. And the first is that the large institutional players have been involved in this from a very early stage, both in developing the SIFMA documentation as participants in that, and then also crafting and commenting on the rule from a very early stage. The consequence of that is that they are really well-versed and they're well-organized with respect to their client outreach and their documentation approach, even in the face of some of the current unknowns. So in that, they have a really big advantage. The second is that many of the clients that we think are the non-trading firms, the non-NBFI firms, are going to opt for the most straightforward and cost-effective options to get to be compliant. So this goes back to the discussion that we had earlier about what service offerings they're going to see, what dealers are going to offer them, and how they are going to approach those individual clients and make their life easy for them. So we think that ultimately these non-trading firms may have a different perspective than the trading firms, and they'll be looking for simple, straightforward solutions that are easy for them to implement. And if you are not prepared and you're not going to them with these simple, straightforward solutions, what will happen is they will simply prune their dealer relationships to manage the transition as efficiently as possible for themselves. So that will mean that a lot of dealers will need to do a lot of groundwork in terms of understanding their clients' business, developing packages, I guess we could say, or developing strategies and outreach strategies to be able to manage that as smoothly or in as straightforwardly as possible for the clients.
Okay, that was really insightful, Sydney, and you've obviously got a lot of experience and wisdom in this space. So with that in mind, are there any similarities between this reg and previous regs that have required sort of repapering efforts? Can we look at anything that's been done previously and draw similar conclusions or lessons learned?
Yeah, so extremely recently, the industry had a similar repapering exercise because of FINRA Rule 4210, where they had to dock up a previously cash business with the MSFTA documents. So there have been similarities already, especially with this delay that we're now seeing in the implementation dates. 4210 went through a series of delays. And I think it is really important that everyone does take note of the traps that people fell into with those delays to 4210, because the deadline kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And both buy side and sell side suffered as a result of those delays in getting their docs in place. And then finally, when the implementation date wasn't delayed and the kind of the final date was set of May 22nd, 2024, there was then a rush to the finish line. So we absolutely do encourage that lessons are learned from that experience, and that even though there are delays in place here, firms continue to take the steps that Sydney and I just mentioned to push towards the finish line now and get everything in place that they can now, rather than putting their pens down, because that was, I think, a massive lesson from 4210 that hopefully everyone can learn from.
Yeah. And Emma, I was around some firms that, you know, they didn't get fully papered by the time they were supposed to be for FINRA 4210. So just to cover for the group, this is where the TBAs and long settle mortgage backed securities, the unrealized gain losses on those needed to be collateralized. And so there needed to be this MSFTA agreement in place. There were firms that had to limit their trading counterparties because they weren't papered across the board. And so it can have economic impacts and impacts to the business if you're not ready. And if you look at the repo space, you know, clients who need to borrow cash, maybe it's not a daily activity, but if they need to borrow cash in any given time and, you know, there's less liquidity in the market on any given day, they really need to be ready with their solution to be covered across potentially different providers, different trading parties, et cetera. So it is really important, especially if repo is a utility you need to be solvent or just have, you know, your bank balance above zero. Super important to have all your ducks in a row and fully set up by the time it's mandatory to clear these.
Okay, so we have covered an awful lot of information today. I'd like to thank Sydney, Emma, and Phil for their insights and their deep expertise in this space. Any closing thoughts before we close our podcast? Any things that firms should be doing, Sydney and Emma? What would be the key takeaway from this discussion?
We've been looking at this implementation timeline like an iceberg. It's an analogy we've become extremely fond of. You look at it from the top and from above the water, it seems like you just need some documents in place to clear. But then when you look below the surface, there is so much work that firms need to do to get ready for this deadline. They need to pick an access model that works for their clients. They need to put documents in place through a whole negotiation process. There's also other supporting documentation that needs to go in place. And then there are also operational concerns that need to be addressed. So there's so much that needs to be ready by the time the new deadlines hit that we would just encourage people to continue to streamline their processes, look at their scope, define their scope, prioritize, and work towards the new deadlines.
Yeah, I look to that saying, you don't know what you don't know, right? And as you unpack all this, you get documentation in place, talk to providers, start to build out your operating model. You will come across things that maybe were unexpected or things you need to do. So yeah, we can certainly echo the start early and be prepared from Tonic.
Brilliant. So firms should use this extension wisely, make sure they plan, prepare and prioritize their documentation, and make sure they've got the operating model to support the new US Treasury clearing mandate. Everyone, thank you so much for your time today. I found that incredibly interesting and insightful. I hope our listeners did too. So with that in mind, thank you very much for joining today's session on US Treasury clearing, and we hope to be back to you soon with another Tonic podcast. Thank you.
Thanks all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Tonic Boom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest developments and industry opinion across capital markets. Visit thetonicconsultancy.com to see more of our expertise-led insights and end-to-end solutions. Tonic. More expertise, more trust, more achieved.